Hello, welcome to episode 4 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. In this episode, I talk to serial entrepreneur and angel investor David Johnson. We talk about his current distributed apps projects, his impressive background, how he went all in on Bitcoin several years ago, and a few other topics. Note that we recorded this conversation about 2 weeks ago. Here we go. Hi, David.
Hey there, Rob.
Thanks for coming on the Bitcoin Game. It's a real honor for me to have you. When I was first getting into Bitcoin, I remember seeing announcements about BitAngels forming and seeing your name as one of the founders of the group. And later, you seemed to become really involved in the Mastercoin protocol. And most recently, I've seen decentralized apps as being a big focus of yours. Are those the three main Bitcoin-related projects you're involved in right now?
Yeah, the DApps Fund is definitely a big focus for me. We've got more than 10 portfolio projects, open source projects that we're supporting now. And so, yeah, it's been a very rewarding year to see this whole model of building decentralized applications that have their own tokens really be adapted by the whole ecosystem, and to see this explosion of projects that are using that model. It's just been really fun to see that evolve. You know, it's definitely, you know, had its ups and downs, and I'd say we have learned an enormous amount about the best practices that are sort of developing for how you hold a crowd sale, best ways to issue a token, how to set expectations with the community, how to communicate with people. So, but I think we've come a long way. I've said at a few conferences recently, I think Ethereum has probably become the gold standard for how you go through that process. They did an enormous amount of work on the legal and regulatory side. They put it together a really great terms of service, sort of a very readable explanation of what these tokens are and what they do and how they work into the Ethereum system and sort of all the risks involved. And I think I'd like to see a lot more projects really emulate all the best practices that they put together. And in fact, I ended up writing a white paper on crowd sale best practices that is open sourced on my GitHub account. So just kind of invite everybody to check that out and give me pull requests, give me ways to improve it. But I pulled a lot of the Ethereum stuff into that recently.
I've heard you reference Ethereum before. Are you involved hands-on with Ethereum, or you just admire what they're doing?
I don't have any day-to-day role with Ethereum, but I've been fairly involved since the beginning, at least talking with Vitalik about the project. Originally, Vitalik was working a bit on the Mastercoin protocol and sort of realized what he really wanted to do was a fully Turing-complete programming language on top of a blockchain. And that's where he really shifted his focus, I guess, last year to founding Ethereum. And we had some really good discussions early on around the issuing of a token and should it be only to those that are mining it, or should it be also to these other pools of people, those that are contributing open source code to the protocol, those that are encouraging the development of the protocol. And so I think those conversations early on helped sort of shape what eventually became their crowd sale. And sort of just thinking through those best practices, that's sort of been one of the things that's lacking a bit in the Bitcoin ecosystem, is there isn't a direct incentive for the developers really working on Bitcoin, right? There's the block reward that incentivizes hashing power, but it's amazing to think that Bitcoin went until, I guess, 2012 without a full-time paid staff working on it. And it was really with the advent of the Bitcoin Foundation that finally Gavin was working full-time on Bitcoin, and then other companies began sponsoring other developers. And really sort of we have almost the completion of that process with Blockstream now hiring the remaining developers to all work full-time on Bitcoin and blockchain-related technologies, that we finally have, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 people working full-time on Bitcoin. But that's sort of been one of the conclusions, is people that are building new incentive systems are baking in a reward for open source developers to contribute code. so that we don't have to rely sort of on corporate sponsors to make that possible.
Can you describe easily what you think the best practices are and how you achieve that?
I think the most important thing is I really encourage projects to shy away from any form of pre-mining. And I think of pre-mining, and I think it's probably best defined, literally as the term implies, somebody that created coins before there was a quantifiable process, right? And sort of the quintessential example is what happened with Ripple, right? They simply created a big pool of tokens. They gave them to the founders. They gave them to, you know, early contributors. But it wasn't really a quantifiable way to earn tokens in that system. What I encourage folks to do is actually define at the earliest possible time, what are the behaviors that can earn you this token? So for example, with Ethereum, they set up a system where anybody that contributed to the project early on participated in the early contributor pool, which I think they end up calling their founder pool or something of that nature. And that's a really compelling idea because they did it as an open source project from the beginning. They did it as open development where everybody could participate. And anybody that added value to that process ended up in that earlier contributed pool. So it wasn't a couple people. They had, I believe, more than 60 people contribute to that, making Ethereum possible before the crowd sale. And then after the crowd sale, right, it's the people adding computational power, running the Ethereum nodes that'll be mining the coins. And I believe they've set aside pools for other purposes as well. But I wouldn't define any of those activities as pre-mine because it was open for everybody from the beginning to participate. And I think that's really an important concept. And we've seen the same from projects like MadeSafe and others that are building out technologies where it's an open system from the beginning and anybody can participate and add value to it.
Have you found it to be a pretty pure process?
I think so. I think the big difference is whether that's a closed process or whether that's an open process. And so I certainly prefer projects where that's an open process. And from the beginning, anybody can contribute, anybody can get involved and earn those tokens. That I think that makes it much more of a community versus something where you have maybe a proprietary company and they're creating some technology and people can only get involved at a later stage. So I think that's a best practice is to open up not only to open source, but as people call it, open development.
Got it. Hey, I'd like to take a step back a little bit, and I'm just really curious, what was your background before you got into Bitcoin?
So I've actually been a serial entrepreneur for the last 14 years or so. Ever since I was real young, I was incorporating companies. I've built online publishing companies back in the early 2000s. I built one of the first online investment banks inside of Second Life. So I had some pretty early exposure to virtual currency in the form of the Linden dollar with Second Life. After that, I actually ended up developing a $6 million biodiesel facility in Maryland that turned poultry fat into biodiesel. I was sort of following the renewable energy trend. I'd done a lot of research and saw sort of where the price of oil was going due to really fundamental factors and decided that all of a sudden renewables were cost competitive. Poultry fat is basically a byproduct of the agricultural industry, and there are 15 million gallons a year produced on the eastern shore of Maryland. So we ended up taking about 5 million gallons a year and turning that into biodiesel. So that was a cool project. I was about 19 at the time. So you definitely got a lot of weird looks when you're 18 or 19 and you're trying to raise $5 or $10 million to build a project. But you know what I found is if people realize that you're well-studied and that you're articulate and that you know what you're talking about, they don't really care how old you are. And so I always encourage people, don't really worry about your age. You can build anything you want as long as you know your stuff and you've studied your industry and you've made yourself an expert.
Wow. So is that it? Or are there more? more businesses?
So that was the second or third. After that, I built a biotech company. We ended up partnering with ConocoPhillips and we built a project in Louisiana for their biofuels division around algae and algae oil production. So that's what got me down south at first. That's where I met my wife in Louisiana. And then actually after that, got back into software. I sort of got tired of raising large amounts of capital for capital-intensive physical projects. It was just a very long, drawn-out process. So it's refreshing to be back in the software world where you can build an actual product and get it up and running for sort of a very reasonable amount of seed capital and get things up and prove traction and stuff like that. So got back into software in 2011, building a natural language processing big data company. That's actually when I moved to Austin in 2012, 2013. And right around that time, a friend, one of my programming friends, was telling me about Bitcoin. And, you know, I sort of came to this conclusion, you know, you're telling me that there's a non-governmental currency that can never be inflated or manipulated by politicians. Yep. Okay, I would like to trade all of my money for that money. And so it took me about 4 months, you know, of time in 2012 to trade all of my fiat for Bitcoin. But it seemed really, really obvious that you know, the fundamentals just made more sense. And why would I want government currency that would always have inflation versus something that would never have inflation? So that was my introduction into Bitcoin.
That's a pretty dramatic move. No fears about somehow governments or, I don't know, some type of an attack or something with this system? Or you researched it really well and felt confident?
I read everything I could get my hands on. I spent thousands of hours on Bitcoin Talk, reading the forums. You know, I was following all the projects I could find in the ecosystem. And what really seems obvious to me is, you know, when people ask, well, what about the government? I can't think of an example in history of a technology that has come along and that governments have been able to stop. It didn't happen with the printing press. It didn't happen with the internet. And these technologies disrupted major, major monopolies in their day. So I can't find any historical precedent for governments actually stopping the progress of a technology over the long term. They can maybe stop it in a particular jurisdiction, but people can always go somewhere else. And technology will flow to whatever the friendliest jurisdiction is. And so, yeah, I didn't have a lot of concerns about that. And even if, you know, governments come down hard, I'd rather be on the side of fighting for technology than sitting on the sideline, you know, fearing, you know, what might happen. So, and I think that fear has really declined over the last few years. We've gotten to a point where we have a lot more regulatory clarity in the last 24 months. We sort of know which jurisdictions are going to be friendlier and which are not going to be as friendly. And so it'll continue to evolve, but I think if the U.S. is unfriendly to cryptocurrency, then it's going to go somewhere else, right? We're already seeing a lot of projects incorporate in Zug, Switzerland, or the Isle of Man, or in Europe where the laws are friendlier. And so it's only a question of where the benefit goes. And so if the policymakers are smart, they won't crush innovation in the U.S. And, you know, I've been pretty lucky. I moved to Austin. And we have the friendliest Bitcoin rules in the country right now. The Banking Commission came out and said, you know, yeah, as long as you follow the federal standards and as long as you're not a custodian of the funds, you know, we don't consider Bitcoin money and you're not a money transmitter, so you don't need a license for a lot of activities. And that really sort of opens the floodgates here. And when just recently we had a ruling on crowdfunding in Texas that, you know, everybody can participate even if they're not an accredited investor up to a certain number of dollars per year. So if New York decides that they're going to be very onerous, there's a nice friendly place that can come here in Austin and join our jurisdiction. So ultimately, I think these things will compete.
Since we're talking about government regulation, I was really curious about yesterday's FinCEN guidance, I guess that now affects Bitcoin payment processors. Have you paid any attention to that?
I've read the recent rulings. I'm sort of following all the debate. Seems to still be a lot of debate about sort of who it encompasses and sort of what the effects are going to be for payment processors. Probably too early to comment on how all of that's going to hash out. But it's sort of funny. I think about there was a great comment made by Gabe at the recent Israeli Bitcoin conference. There was a politician from Israel talking about the regulation of Bitcoin. And he asked her, you know, instead of thinking about regulating Bitcoin, you should think about how the Bitcoin can regulate the government. She sort of hadn't thought about it in that frame before. But when you think about it, a lot of what Bitcoin is its transparency, its accountability. It's an immutable third-party ledger that nobody can change the records of. And that's pretty powerful for holding, you know, these existing financial institutions accountable. You know, one example that I like to use is, you know, Bank of America last year paid $17 billion in fines as part of that big robo-signing scandal, where basically they just lost track of who owned which mortgage and, you know, who was making payments on which mortgage. They were foreclosing on the wrong people and stuff like this. It was basically a failure of a system of record. They had some paper and they had some stuff in their database and they couldn't keep track of who owned what. I look at projects like Factum and what they're doing with proof of existence and proof of process and proof of audit, where you could actually construct a system of record that no third party can alter by taking documents, hashing them, and then placing that transaction into the Bitcoin blockchain. You now have a permanent way to prove that that document existed in exactly that form at exactly that time. And do this with millions of documents and put them into a single transaction secured in the Bitcoin ledger. That's really cool. Not only does it solve the bloat problem, but we can start to use those kind of tools to create really cryptographically solid systems around how you prove a particular document existed at a particular time. So you think about that use case for Bank of America, that's a pretty big deal if they can avoid $17 billion fines in the future and all they have to do is implement this type of system where their records are getting hashed and their records are getting time stamped using something like Factum. That's really game changing to me. The stuff that really gets me excited is the big infrastructure plays like that.
Are there other startups, or I guess, do you call it a startup when they're in your decentralized app? Or what do you call it?
That's a good question. No, I don't really think of them as startups. I think of them as open source projects. If you go to dapsfund.com, you can see all the projects that we're leading due diligence on or involved in there. It's really those big infrastructure ones that get me excited. You know, I've been following the updates from MadeSafe. They're just moving into Testnet too. I was catching up with Nick Lambert when I was in London for the Bitcoin conference there. And I'm really impressed with the progress they've made in their proof of concepts test nets. I'm really excited to see that get closer to a live production net because, I think about it as like BitTorrent on steroids, right? Here's a distributed storage network that rewards people for adding storage to the network. And now that there's a token, now there's a market I can go and grab as much space as I want for distributed storage. So there's a lot of programs that I'm talking to that are sort of building on top of those capabilities. So we're starting to see second or third generation protocols where like, okay, now MadeSafe exists and now Factum exists. I want to build this other thing that builds on top of those. So yeah, it's exciting to see the leveraging that's going on. So for example, Lazus just launched in Israel. They're the distributed transportation protocol. And, you know, that's a really exciting use case that leverages, you know, the master protocol to issue their token, and they leverage a bunch of other systems, but basically rewarding people directly for providing transportation or adding value to that system. So that's a really cool project. I've been following it for a while. They were one of the winners of the Texas Bitcoin Hackathon that we sponsored back in March. And just really excited to see that's now an app that you can download on your Android phone and start earning Zeus. And once it hits a certain critical mass, then it unlocks in a particular city. So that's a cool project. But we're really still at the very early stages where we've got all these big infrastructure projects that we need to put in place before we can do the higher level stuff.
So are all the different decentralized apps that you're working with, are they all at the core based on the Bitcoin blockchain?
For the most part, what I usually tell folks is if you just want to issue a token and you just want to transfer value and keep track of ownership, the master protocol, the Bitcoin blockchain, is a pretty tried and true way of doing that. And why would you want to pay essentially the miner's tax to create some much smaller blockchain that's much more vulnerable to attack, much more vulnerable to, you know, miners trying to do a 51% event, as we've seen with Feathercoin and, you know, Aurora Coin and others in the past? Why wouldn't you just issue that on top of the blockchain? Now, I leave an exception where if you've got some consensus mechanism that is radically different than Bitcoin, and you need miners to be involved in that different consensus mechanism, let's take Ethereum, for example, then it makes perfect sense to have your own blockchain. And so that's sort of the test for me, is if you're just issuing a token, then do it on top of the blockchain. It's a great, secure, well-tested cryptographic ledger. If you're trying to do some other consensus mechanism, you know, okay, maybe you need your own blockchain for that. But I would think hard about it before you do.
So you have a decentralized apps fund, and I'm assuming that's a way people can invest in the decentralized apps you're working on, or what is that exactly?
So the fund is a venture capital group, right? So we have limited partners, basically investors that have all put together their cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Mastercoin, other coins, into the fund. And the fund invests as one entity into the crowd sales or the token issuances that people have, right? So, you know, we don't invest in shares. We don't invest in equity. We're only interested in digital tokens associated with open source protocols. And so that's our whole mandate. We're probably the first venture fund ever to raise all the money in cryptocurrency, invest all the money as cryptocurrency, and seek to have all the properties that we buy be digital tokens. So this is separate from the BitAngels, which is a decentralized angel group where individual angel investors are making investment decisions. The DApps fund works as one entity, and all the funds are pooled together, and I and Sam Yilmaz act as the general partners, and we invest the funds into the open source projects directly.
Do you have to be an accredited investor, or could anybody somehow get involved with this fund?
Yeah, so the fund is purely for accredited investors. So just mostly larger investors that we've worked with on other projects. So it's interesting. I expect that Bitcoin technology will also disrupt the venture capital model. And so I'm doing a lot of thinking about that right now and starting to work on a white paper, starting to work on a project that I'll probably talk more about next year. When it comes to, you know, future funds, I'd like to do something that's much more decentralized and much more open and really creates things more along the Bitcoin ethos. So I'm researching what's really the best way to make that happen. So beginning to pull in thought leaders and people that are interested in that. But yeah, I'll probably talk more about that next year as sort of that comes together and the pieces become more clear about how you really do something like that. But the running this first fund has been a huge learning experience. It's my first venture fund. I've been an entrepreneur before this until I founded the BitAngels last year with Michael Turpin and Sam Yilmaz. So I've kind of been going through this transition the last couple of years from entrepreneur to investor. So it's definitely different to be on the other side of the table.
Any scenarios that you weren't expecting or any lessons to share? Is it a little more complex than that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably the nerdiest VC. And so, you know, I tend to go really, really deep on the technical stuff.
Okay, and let me just stop you there because I've been wanting to ask. I mean, you seem to be just everything, entrepreneurial, technical. How technical are you?
Well, I'll help write white papers. I will look at code bases. I have an active GitHub account. I don't write much code, and I don't have any formal training or degree in software or anything in that. In fact, I dropped out of college to build the biodiesel plant back in 2006, 2005, and sort of never looked back. So I don't know. I don't really have any formal training in anything. I'm autodidact. I was homeschooled from when I was a kid. And so I'm used to sort of teaching myself about different subjects or different industries. And usually it's not easy. It's not magic. It's thousands of hours of research on a particular topic.
Seems like a good combination of nature and nurture in your case. It's pretty impressive now as I'm learning all these details about your background.
A lot of what I do is reading people's white papers. I like to get involved in projects at the really, really early stage. So, you know, if you've got a project and you're going to tell me about it, don't wait till you're 6 months down the line. Talk to me at the beginning. I want to hear about projects when they're an idea on a whiteboard and somebody's writing up a white paper, because I like to get involved in sort of debating and understanding what are the best technologies somebody can use, what are the right platforms for them to build things on top of. So I get involved at really, really early stages. Even if that's before the fund will get involved, I really like to look at papers. There's more white papers that people send me than I even have time to look at. But that's where I spend a lot of my time, is I think about things from a very fundamental perspective. I think about whether a project makes sense from the perspective of not only is the technology going to work, but is the market demanding this? You know, what are the fundamentals of how it's implemented? You know, and a lot of when I decide to, you know, spend a lot of time on a project is I've become convinced that there's a huge demand in the market for it, that the fundamental technology is ready. I think sort of user-facing things that, you know, are sort of very high level are probably too early right now. And a lot of my focus is on, okay, what's the infrastructure we need to build first? So, but anyway, so that's a lot of my process, is trying to evaluate things from a very fundamental perspective. Teams can be built, you know, programmers can be hired, experts can be found, but the thing, the project has to make sense from a very fundamental perspective. Like, is it a problem that needs to be solved? Is it the one that we now have the technology to solve? And basic questions like that.
Are there other decentralized apps or anything in that whole direction that you feel like talking about? Or
like I said, on dapsfund.com, you can see all the projects that we're looking at. There's a lot of really cool, exciting stuff. I'm a big fan of storage and what they're doing. They were another one of the winners that came out of the Texas Bitcoin conference. Like I said, following closely on MadeSafe. I'm really excited about API Network. I actually got a chance to go to London a few weeks ago and speak at the app conference put on by Programmable Web and talk about how cryptocurrency is going to change the world when it comes to APIs and monetizing APIs. So that was a lot of fun. I'll probably post the video on the website. I think it's already posted on the API Network website. BlockAuth is pretty cool too. I've been following that really closely. It's, you know, how do we decentralize the way identities are verified so we can get away from this situation like Kmart or Home Depot or Chase, where there's a big database of identities all sitting in a one location, and a hacker just has to break that one location and they get 50 million identifiers.
Can I ask you about that? Yeah. Oh, I'm just wondering, with hopefully the way things are going with digital currencies and stuff, I mean, will there be a need to tie identities, I guess maybe for shipping, or is that not even something people will be storing in the future?
So unfortunately, the laws are written in the way right now where they basically require companies through Know Your Customer standards to keep this data.
So even Walmart has to keep data on all whoever buys a whatever?
Is that exactly. Walmart, and they're taking names, they're taking all that information. In the case of Target, right, all the people that had Target debit cards. So it's really a difference in security models. So Andreas and Antonopoulos articulated this really well in his talk to the Senate Canadian committee on this subject, and I recommend people go look at the video and what he talked about. But basically, it's a difference between centralized and decentralized data architectures for data security, right? The centralized assumption is that, well, if we put all of these 50 million IDs in one place, We can keep them safe. And that's proven again and again to be wrong. It's proven that that creates a systematic and systemic risk where if you break that single point of centralization, then you get all of those IDs. Instead, what I think makes sense is to have all of those identifiers owned by the people that actually own that information. Now, so you have your own information stored with your own private key, and you have a multi-signature type of architecture where, you know, the user would have to sign that information away for, you know, the database to access it. So like you buy something and basically with your signature, you're saying, okay, you can look into this information and verify my identity. Now, they verify your identity, it becomes re-encrypted. And if they ever need that information in the future, you have to give them permission again, right? You're not giving them perpetual permission to store your identity forever, right? That's a one-time event. It's not something that they pull into their system. And that's really where we need to go, I think, with security in general, is push the security out to the endpoints, right? The endpoints being the users that actually own that data, right? Because then for a big security event to happen, you'd have to actually hack in to all of those individual users, right? And users have different operating systems, and they have different ways they're storing their passwords, and they have different phones and different computers. And the idea that all of a sudden you'd hack 50 million individual people, is the chances of that are much, much lower than hacking a single database from Kmart, right, where you get all of those IDs at once, right? So I think that's a really important shift and a huge advantage that the blockchain technology can bring to data security in general.
Sure. And I did interrupt you. What was the project you thought that was addressing that well?
BlockOff by Adam Brown has been tackling that. They've launched a beta or an alpha version. I think they're building towards their beta. I believe it's just BlockOff.com, but definitely worth looking at. He's talking to a lot of people that basically want to do identity verification, and then it's held by the actual user themselves, the private keys to that. So I think that's a really important move.
Great. Was there anything else along those lines that you were – I keep throwing you off track, I know, with my questions, but
No, it's good. It's good. I'm also following the DERPA project, the one working on creating an incentive for Tor nodes. It's a harder technological problem of how you maintain anonymity and at the same time reward people with the token for providing the value. So that's definitely something I'm keeping an eye on, though. I'm a big fan of Rivets, actually. Steven Sprague, I think, is doing some incredible stuff there. Rivets is R-I-V-E-T-Z .com, I believe. And, you know, basically he's trying to leverage the trusted computing element inside of all of our phones and PCs and using that to create like a Trezor style or Trezor level security experience inside of our existing devices.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, I had no idea before I met Steven earlier this year that, you know, sort of all the work that's already been done with trusted computing to build a chip on top of your motherboard that has a private key and a public key that's completely isolated from the main operating system.
So I think the new iOS devices have a setup like that. Do other devices too?
Yes. Actually, Apple is sort of late to the party. It's already been a standard on Intel and AMD and the other chip manufacturers for the last 2 or 3 years. I believe Steven said there's around 500 million devices now that all have these trusted computing elements built into their chipsets. And it's something like 300 or 400 million a year getting shipped now.
Wow.
Most people already have this in their device, and it's just, it hasn't been widely used, right? It's sort of been a technology in search of a use case, right? Because who needs public and private key pairs, right? Before Bitcoin, that was sort of, you know, an esoteric thing that companies tried to use for other purposes. But this is sort of like a really direct use. Oh, I have money. I have a private key. I would like to store my private key, you know, securely on this device without any other program being able to get to it.
There's probably few people who see as many white papers and have their pulse on all the different projects people are doing than you, I would imagine. Who else is in that company, do you think, of people who really are seeing a lot of ideas?
There's a few people that are really heavily involved in the 2.0 space. You know, Brock Pierce looks at a lot of different projects. He's probably one of the most active angel investors in the Bitcoin space. Barry from Second Market is known for a lot of his investments in the Bitcoin ecosystem. I'm a big fan of Matt Rosnack from Tally Capital. They've backed some of the coolest projects, including the recent, you know, I believe they were involved in supporting development of sidechains. And they've certainly been looking at a lot of 2.0 projects. And so Matt Rosnack is great. He spends a lot of time on these 2.0 projects. You know, Elise out of March Capital is great as well, focused on these 2.0 projects. So there's a growing wave of venture capitalists that are sort of wrapping their head around the big potential here. And so while the DAPS Fund was probably first to focus on this segment, I wouldn't be surprised if there were, you know, a dozen VC funds in the next year focused on this space. I mean, we're really just starting to see the beginning of it. You know, last year, these crowd sales, selling software were in the millions of dollars. This year, you know, with Ethereum and MadeSafe and other projects, it's reached tens of millions of dollars. I'm starting to see the first sort of credible entrepreneurs talk to me about even larger crowd sales next year. So I think this is a whole new asset class. Like, this is a whole new type of asset that hasn't existed before, these tokens that access these open source software protocols. And Bitcoin was the first, but I think it's going to give birth to this whole new wave of projects using the same model.
Interesting. You have any reaction to the, I guess, Adam Bach and company's pegged sidechains?
I'm a fan. I think the research for sidechains and tree chains is really important because it's basically around the scalability of Bitcoin. And how do we handle transactions and experimentation with new ways of building blockchains while still leveraging the security of the main Bitcoin blockchain. So I'm a big fan. I think you'll see a lot of projects as those technologies mature, move over. So, you know, I know the Master Protocol OmniWallet guys are talking about the options for migrating to a sidechain as they become available. And so I expect we'll see a lot of projects take advantage of that technology. One of the things that will take time is sort of building consensus among the community and addressing sort of all the technical considerations. But I think that can be done. I think the white paper they released was really compelling. I had a chance to read it over the weekend. And yeah, I thought it was very thoughtful and well written. So I'm hoping to see more come out from them pretty soon.
Could, say, Factum's separate federated servers with the microchains, could that be considered a type of a sidechain, or is that a different animal?
It's a pretty different animal. With sidechains, you're really creating this ability to create these different tokens, run them on their own blockchain, and connect that to the Bitcoin blockchain. You're essentially extending those type of capabilities, where with Factum, it's really about the time stamping. Right, you're extending the timestamp abilities of the blockchain to the rest of the internet. So you can take vast amounts of data and timestamp it and do this proof of process and proof of audit. So they're very different sort of in the services they provide, but I think they're both pretty important. And there's no reason that they can't, you know, be very interoperable. I fully expect that, you know, Factum may well live on top of a sidechain or leverage that technology in different ways. But they don't seem to have much overlap in their capabilities or the services they provide.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Are there any other projects or many other projects that use a Factum-style separate chain to do any type of accounting, or is that a pretty unique situation?
I think it's pretty unique. I haven't seen any other projects yet that are taking the Factum approach when it comes to solving the bloat problem or creating a situation where you could run transactions and use this proof of audit and audit real-time auditing system in order to assure that, you know, transactions happening off-chain are being done correctly. And then once they get merged into the Bitcoin ledger, then it's recorded sort of permanently and forever. So I haven't seen anybody that's really accomplished that yet. I think Factum is pretty far along the road as far as actually getting that implemented with their proof of concept and the white paper they're putting together. I expect they'll release a lot more information probably mid-November as they get to sort of version one of their white paper and make sort of bring the broader community into invite the broader community into what they're doing.
Do you have any advice since you've seemed like such a successful person and just about everything you try, any just general life advice that's helped you?
I think a lot of it is persistence. So I find the difference between entrepreneurs that are successful and those that aren't. A lot of it has to do with persistence. You come up against a lot of hurdles, and it's sort of up to you to be the one that says, we can get over this and we can, you know, find a way to move forward. And you know, it's sort of even goes back to my childhood when I was reading about Thomas Edison and guys like that. You know, he would get the same kind of question around, well, you know, how did it feel to, you know, fail 2,000 times to, you know, find the right way to make the light bulb? And he said, you know, well, I don't really think of it as failing. I think of it as I discovered 2,000 ways not to make a light bulb. And that's pretty much what it feels like to do a startup. Right? Because you come up with an idea and you come up with a concept. And I see it very much the same way. You have to experiment with different ways to accomplish that goal. And it could take you 40 or 50 or 60 or 100 times, you know, of different experiments, different approaches. Maybe you need different team members with different skills. You know, as long as you keep adapting, you can move the project forward. But as soon as you stop adapting, the project dies, right? So that's sort of my overlying, you know, advice for entrepreneurs is adapt or die. If you're not getting the results that you need, change something about what you're doing and try something else, right? These are experiments that we're running, and we don't know which are going to be successful until you run the experiment. So one, you have to run the experiment. Don't just think about it. Go out there and run experiments. And then if something doesn't work, change something you're doing and do it scientifically, do it methodically, and you'll come up with answers around what works and what doesn't.
Great. Well, I can't thank you enough for spending time with me today. It's really a pleasure to get to ask you these questions.
Thanks, Rob. A lot of fun talking, and happy to do it anytime.
Today's magic word is autodidact, which means self-taught. It's spelled A-U-T-O. D-I-D-A-C-T. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB coin distribution on letstalkbitcoin.com. You have 4 days to do so. Please follow me on Twitter at TheBTCGame, and you can also give me feedback on the episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. And if you go to thebitcoingame.com, you'll get to a list of all my podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.
Something. She let's turn around.
BitTorrent.